Hello, welcome and good evening to One Game at a Time. This is the second time we're coming to you, our episode being called Captain Lonsdale's Cow Paddock. In our previous episode, we looked at the origins of the game, and I suppose that means that in this episode, we're actually looking at the origins of our wonderful game. If you're tuning in for the first time, we're absolutely in love with Australian rules football. Somehow we all have beautiful partners. I don't know how it really happened, because our true love is the Australian game, and it's what we do most of the time and what we're thinking about when we're going through our lives, I suppose. It's good evening to Ryan Miller.
Evening, Liam.
And it's good evening to my handsome brother, Finn O'Sullivan.
Good evening, gentlemen.
And you may not hear it from his voice, but he can kick on both feet and also play the piano.
Is that right?
It sure is.
Not at the same time.
Yeah, that's true. Our podcast this evening is called Captain Lonsdale's Cow Paddock. And just to frame the geography of Melbourne at the time when Scotch and Melbourne Grammar got together to play their game, we're talking about a colony that's been around for just over 20 years. It's become the wealthiest in New South Wales or Australia, whatever you want to call the colony at the time. And what we now know as Victoria has become incredibly wealthy because of a huge gold rush, something that has seen people travel across the seas to come and find gold here. And Governor Latrobe, of the very Latrobe Street you may well have been down tonight on your way home, is running the show. He's the reason for the £1 miner's license, and that's what makes Victoria incredibly rich. And Captain Lonsdale is the guy who decides to make parkland around Melbourne a real thing, and to make it happen. Finn, what was football like at the very start of the game?
You would start off in the centre with a kick. It would go as far as you would, far as you'd want it to go, into the hands of the other side. Now, before I continue, just in case the listeners didn't listen to episode one, yeah, you can get it on our Twitter feed and Origins of Footy.
Nice work.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Miller. Is that teams naturally were on their half of the ground. So if we take the case of the Melbourne Grammar versus Scotch College, imagine Scotch College is on one side and Melbourne Grammar is on the other side. Mm. And Melbourne Grammar would kick into their half. Basically, they could mark the ball, as in today, would have a free kick. And from there, you need to imagine that passing was still in its real primitive form. Passing wasn't a thing, something that's called scientific football, as it was referred to in one of the books that I read, is that it was still a pack formation. One person would have the ball, and a pack would develop behind them, kind of like a scrum if you think about it. And the closest and the only way to goal was straight line. There was no, you know, back and forth, this and that. It was just pushing through any way you can, hacking, pushing, tripping.
And in a sense, how it if you wound continued. Up being out on your own with the ball, it was dangerous for your team. You were likely to have the ball taken from you by the opposition. Is it the case that the aim was to get the ball back into the pack, really?
Absolutely.
Gain yardage and then get the ball back into the pack into what is effectively a scrum or ruck?
Because remember, in these early stages, you people weren't running with the ball.
Mm. So you kicked the ball from that mark?
Yeah, absolutely. You would kick it right back into the other half.
Yeah, so it just shows how fond of the game I am. I see this ball right from the start getting kicked and the bloke getting it and running as fast as he can.
Yeah.
But you get the ball and
Stop
and then kick for territory.
Kick it back again.
Or place it. Or when the ball's in dispute, it's effectively in a
Kind of in a scrum or bully, yeah. Much like Eton. And this particular game that we're talking about was 1 year before the rules were written in 1859 that Melbourne Grammar versus Scotch College in 1858, the same year as the Sheffield rules were written. Mm-hmm. That this was done in Captain Lonsdale's cow paddock, or as our listeners would know it as Yarra Park. Kind of, if you imagine where Brunton Avenue is and you push up the hill to Jolimont Station, that's the ground.
Yeah, and that
how big is that, Finny?
That's about 800 meters.
Yeah, and the origins of that politically are Latrobe in 1856 decrees, if that's correct, an 81-hectare space of parkland that runs from Punt Road in Richmond all the way to what is now the beginning of Swanson Street, and running the other way, it's from Wellington all the way down to the Yarra River. So you've got to imagine a space there where Yarra Park is, where the MCG does exist but isn't surrounded by enormous stands, and the Jolimont train line is not there yet. So you've got a huge space, it's still a huge space, but it is then, at that point, 1856, which is 2 years previous to the Scotch and Melbourne Grammar game, as being said, this is parkland and this will remain to be parkland.
So, Finny, obviously at the time, enormous field, brand new sport,
yep,
and brand new type of football, if we want to call it that. Seven blokes in a pub decide that this is what we're going to do.
Yep.
What was the score? More to the point.
This game?
Yeah, who won?
This game. Oh, it was nil all.
But I
think the interesting thing is that people may not know is that this game went for 3 weeks.
Mm. Right.
So, and so if my memory Hugo serves me correctly.
Little Hugo and little Tarquin at the end of it were pretty tired.
And for anyone that thinks a 5-day test match is a waste of time, this is a real problem.
3-week game of footy.
Yeah.
The 7th of August, 14th of August, 21st of August, 1858. This game kept going, and
it's like a game of Risk over a summer holidays, isn't it?
it kept going, and it was like, to have official bragging rights, not that it was written down. Of course, well, nothing was written down at this particular stage. Were first to 2 goals, and that occurred in one of the English games that we talked about last podcast.
Mm.
But that never occurred, and the game only ended because of the sun going down.
Yeah, so it's a year later. It's 1859, and how many guys, Finn, in the hotel? And
well, look, it's credited. If you go to the G, you'll see that on the wall it's written that there's 7 men. But really, I think we want to just focus on the main four, being Smith, Hammersley, Thompson, and of course Tom Wills.
Yeah, so Wills incredibly out of favour for a lot of history, but then from about, 96 or 97 onwards, people start to see him as, in fact, a real father of the sport. Incredibly gifted cricketer and footballer. If you're at the MCG and you see the origins of football, bronze statue?
Yeah,
he's the guy who's umpiring the game. In some ways has a terrible life, but in many ways is the guy who forces this game on Melbourne and forces some changes to rules after the point of them putting the rules together. So let's talk through the rules first off that are written down in 1859, yep. Finn. There's a few that are not so exciting about the distance between the goal posts shall be decided by the captains, which is, for anyone who's ever played schoolyard football, it's like, look, it's between the jumpers over there, all right?
Yeah, which is exactly, yeah.
Yeah, and if it gets stuck in the tree, it's not a goal. Those sort of rules. Yeah. But down to rules that effectively are around safety. So rule 7 is tripping and pushing are both allowed, but no hacking.
Yeah.
That's legitimately a rule. You know, people thought to write that down. You can't hack, but sure, trip and push as much as you like. And that very quickly gets changed and added to the banned list. Any others of note that you'd like to pick out?
Rule 8, the ball may be taken in hand only when caught from the foot or on the hop.
Explain on the hop for us.
On the hop is basically when the ball is in motion. It's bouncing, not rolling along the ground, not static on the ground. You've kicked the footy, you've miskicked it, and it bounces along the ground. And today, a player would just pick it up and run.
Yeah, so it's out of the air, not off the ground.
Yep, so yeah. Out of the air, it bounces along. You're able to pick that up if it kind of hops up to you, I guess, yeah. And it also says, in no case shall it be lifted from the ground. So, yeah, listeners need to realise that you couldn't just pick up the ball.
Yeah, I think another part is that the captain's umpire the game. Yep. So, like, exactly like in schoolyard footy, the people who know the most, the most senior or mature or whatever, they're the ones who make the decisions. They're the ones who stop the game. And they truly stop the game to decide on, is this right or wrong? And you can just see it happening. There's this sense that the captains on each side toss not only for the choice of goal, but they're equally doing things like that all the time. They're deciding what will stand and what won't stand. And even if there's rules, they're deciding on verification on those rules. Miller?
Oh, look, I just think a point to remember is obviously where these guys came from, and the fact that these rules don't come up by chance is because of their own experiences. Mm-hmm. The fact that, mentioned this idea that you can't pick the ball up, but this idea of knocking or pushing it forward, you look at the Sheffield rules, 1858, like, you know, almost word for word. Whether or not there's a link there, you know, is slightly debatable, but you know, we think maybe there is. If you look at the Eton game and you know what these guys were exposed to earlier in their lives and what would have been talked around football clubs and things like that over in England, Will's at rugby school, obviously the idea of moving the ball any other way than in a scrum is totally foreign. Like, it's something that's not has ever been done before. It's not like there's a guy, you know, that, you know, this whole idea of William Ebbers picking the ball up and running with it.
Yeah.
It seems like a beautiful story, but it's slightly farcical and probably not something that happened even.
Yes.
But certainly, you know, leading up to that point, 100 years before, that would be an insane thing to do. You know, the fact that you've got to keep it in this scrum for safety, this close together way of playing the game.
Mob mentality.
In England, mob mentality, yeah. Exactly right. Moving the game back to its origins, mob football, don't let the ball out. It's a safe thing to do, because if you run off on your own, the danger is you're probably going to get whacked.
Absolutely.
And you're going to lose a ball. So your safety in numbers is probably the basis of it. So
and
yeah,
if you've seen Gladiator, the bloke who doesn't come together with the rest of them, what happens to
yeah.
him is
Russell Crowe is not happy
about.
With him. No. Yeah, he's very cross. But yeah, I think the idea that the majority of these rules written down have come straight out of other things. It's just the way that they've been amalgamated so effectively, really, that makes it, I suppose, all the more brilliant, really.
Yeah, the not by chance is absolutely correct.
Yeah.
Because Hammersley and Thompson were from Cambridge themselves.
Yeah.
And it's certainly they made it no secret that they wanted a dribbling style game, just like the Cambridge game. And Wills, who certainly wasn't going to back down from an argument, was from rugby school, who, of course, have that running style of game. And what's interesting is that because these men were public schoolboys, but our game wasn't built around a school. It was quite independent of a school. That's obvious by being created in a pub itself, is that we were able in Melbourne to... We accelerated much faster than the English game because they could take, I guess, the issues that the English games had with, you know, debating over what rules, you know, should we play this, should we play that. And the fact that Hammersley and Thompson were both journalists at the time, that one was from the Argus, one was from Bell's Life, is that they could also put it out to public debate really quickly. And I guess then the public started to become involved. Yeah. You could debate about this rule. No, this rule doesn't look good. No, that rule's too harsh, et cetera, et cetera. So our game, you know, vastly changed within years rather than, as we discussed in our last podcast, took centuries.
Mm.
You can see the opportunity there that exists. If you've done something previously and had some experience and then you bring it to an entirely new group and want to put together exactly what you want.
Mm.
Take when you've heard a joke, for example, and you want to bring it to an entirely new group and shape it the way that you want to get the maximum effect. This is effectively what these guys have done with sport. They've experienced it at an organized level at universities or high schools in Britain, brought it here, got together and decided, geez, we like this thing, but fuck, let's get it right. Let's get it right here and now, and let's make it enjoyable for the masses. Now, the quote that hits me is from the Time and Space book by Coventry. Thank you, Mr. Coventry, if you're listening. Hammersley himself recalled that they had aimed to, quote, draw up as simple a code of rules and as few as possible so that anyone could understand. They've got this sense of not only is it a beautiful game that they're going to make, but equally they're in the very origins of a colony that's going to be big. And presumably these guys have got the vision to see that this is a game that may well be the game for the city.
Well, they've got a clean slate for the first time. You know, a lot of them have come from these really restricted... You right there, Finny? Really restricted. We're enjoying a beer, ladies and gentlemen. And Finney's only dropped his on the microphone. It was near the end of podcast number two. But we've got a situation where, you know, seven guys have basically got a complete clean slate. They're not restricted by 100 years of documented invasion game. They've got an ideal situation in a wealthy town that is basically going to allow them to play, knowing that it's inevitable that people want recreation. They're going to be able to, I suppose, mould exactly what they want. It's probably the greatest opportunity of all time, really, as a sports nut.
Yeah. When they decide to meet for a beer to talk about it and probably to write down the rules, they may not have understood how big it was going to be, but they knew how simple it needed to be. And the really clear thing is it appears that they wanted to make it easy to learn. Now, for the success of any sport, as anyone who's ever been to Mount Buller understands, you need to be able to learn the sport quickly and simply as you can when you go to ski. You take a lesson, you know how to do it, off you go, you're going to enjoy it, more people are going to learn to do it. They've done that very same thing with football. They've made the rules really articulate and simple to understand. My favourite rule out of the lot is Rule 10. The ball, while in play, may under no circumstances be thrown. Really simple and makes it completely different completely different from what will become rugby.
It'll never be the same. That's the rule for me. You're looking at it. It's totally, it's so bold because of the fact that as a rugby person, really, or a person who grew up as a kid playing rugby, that would have been totally infuriating if somebody told me that I couldn't do that. And it, you know, this totally new sort of idea that you can't move the ball by throwing it, amazing sort of foresight, I guess, that it was going to restrict certain things and therefore allow them to develop the game in a different way.
Yeah, and the rule that really we're going to move to next, I suppose, is the fact that offside's never legislated. Now, in our previous episode, we talk about how Sheffield did not legislate for offside. Sheffield could have become an Australian rules without the use of hands.
Mm.
Had some smart ass have said, well, I'm just going to start down at the goal end, and if someone kicks it long to me, there's no rule to say that offside exists. So there's still this sense, we presume, that when Wills, Hammersley, these guys are playing, that there is an imaginary offside line. But I think it's Finn. You've got the history of how that was challenged, bent, and broken as a even possibility of a rule in Australian rules.
Absolutely. So it was Wills that did it at the time in 1860. He basically placed Richmond on one side, Melbourne on the other side. He sent his seven or eight Richmond men into Melbourne's half.
Mm. So effectively, you've got the pack, and then you have one guy standing 10 metres on the opposition's half, and then another guy 10 metres in advance of him,
mm-hmm.
10 metres in advance of him, effectively making a beeline for the goal. And what's the presumption about what happened here from the opposition?
The complete disbelief. Almost stopping the game.
Fury.
Yeah. Confusion.
Mm.
So I guess it's difficult for our listeners to imagine that, but I guess that you kind of have to understand that this was not only was passing not a thing, which is also difficult to understand, but placing your men in someone else's half was not ever done. And even as you discussed before, Liam, even though the Sheffield game said that it wasn't legislated, it's certainly up for debate whether it was done or not.
Yeah, our view is that it was gentlemanly observed. It was the right thing to do. It was how the game should be played in some way.
There's no doubt in my mind this is influenced by the public school system, again, about the fact that you can say there's no offside lines and that's fine, but they've been pretty much every activity for a long time before had offside lines right down the middle of the ground. So people were, I think, obeying that. And like you say, gentlemanly conduct, I think it's exactly the right way of describing it.
Yes.
But that has been influenced by other things.
But these are men playing this game, aren't they, Finn? So when these rules are, I suppose, on this day, Wills decides to bend them. Because what ultimately happens is the ball is shunted out from the pack just ahead of where the scrum,
mm-hmm.
whatever you call that, the ruck is. The bloke 10 metres ahead of the pack kicks the next bloke, he kicks the next bloke, kicks the next bloke.
Almost a passing game.
And that's brand new, really. But you can imagine if someone did that at Eton or at rugby, that they would have said, "Sir, they're not playing a game properly." And, "Sir..."
Sorry, listeners, we're going to have to make him do that again. what did they do?
You'd imagine that the teacher would come over and say, "No, that's not how we play the game. You get back onside because that's what we do here at Eton." And teachers kind of do that. They enforce rules that are not necessarily rules. They're just conventions.
Yeah.
But in a place like Yarra Park, in a brand new colony where there's a bunch of blokes who are trying to craft a game that they reckon might be exciting, there's no principal, brother, whatever to appeal to.
Mm.
There's just two captains out in the field with a bunch of 40 blokes who are the baker and the butcher and the candlestick maker.
No,
and they're deciding then and there how it's going to go.
But, and it's, again, I guess the idea that there's people observing this who understand what the rules are in place to a certain extent. And any sort of inquisitive sports person, they get into that stuff and they want to know what's going on, and it's sort of like this open debate on the field,
And also within the media as well, because Hammersley and Thompson were completely against this style of play. So you're going to get people for and against, really barracking. Absolutely straight away. And Coventry, James Coventry says, in one fell swoop, he Wills changed the course of this game. And he says it's arguably the most important and influential tactical manoeuvre in the history of Australian footy. I mean, huge call. Yeah,
it is. No, but there's no other game like it.
The breaking of the offside line. It's beyond innovative, really, if you think about it. Like, it's cheeky, so far. It is cheating, probably, in the views of many, and that's how probably it was reported.
Well, coup de main is a French phrase for sudden attack.
Yeah.
So I guess, it would be deemed unfair.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's really interesting, like we said, the restrictions around the public school system and the fact that something like this maybe couldn't have happened because everything was so stringent, written down, strict, all that kind of stuff. This is why when people get very romantic about the idea that maybe William Mebb Ellis picked up the soccer ball or picked up the ball and ran with it, that somehow would have happened. And that's where I get very skeptical about that kind of thing. Yeah. That there may be, yes.
Yeah. But people.
Oh, Ellis has invented a new game.
Yeah.
No, that, I'm not
well done with him.
Yeah, I'm not sure that would have happened. But yeah, so, but in this
people
environment,
want that dream,
but in
they?
This environment, yeah. You can totally see it.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And the very fact that it happens changes the game forever. Because once that offside line's broken, it's no longer a 180 degrees game.
Yeah, that's right.
Even if you start facing off like that, the game becomes everyone spreads. And for years, for decades after that, the game does start bang in the middle with a kickoff. You know, even with a chant that they say, are you ready or whatever. There's some word that they say like that. They kick the ball off. And then everyone runs to positions, essentially. But it takes one little move, effectively by a smart-ass guy who says, well, who's going to challenge me? And you get the sense
wrote the rules.
That Wills is that sort of guy.
Yeah.
He's like, challenge me. I'm the best at this game. I've put the most thought into it. And actually, I did want to say before, while these games are written down, literacy is not a high thing in the 19th century. The fact that there's only 10 rules means that you don't have to be able to read and write.
Mm.
They can be explained to you really quickly. So if you're fresh off the boat from England or Ireland, you can say, well, what are they up to? Explain the game to me. And within...
Can't throw.
20 minutes.
Yeah. Gotcha.
Yeah. And it would be a what happens when. And you can imagine the conversation, the crowd being, well, that depends on whether Wills is playing or not.
Yeah.
You know, because you can presume that even after this coup de main that you talk about, Finn, which is the sequence of players from the middle to the goal, there's other games still going on in the colony that observe the gentlemanly way of play. It may have been the case even that Wills wasn't the first to do it. He's just the first documented guy to do it in what
absolutely.
Is the highest form of the game or the documented form of the game. It's also worth noting that I presume that the offside line is designed really for an element of safety, because if you're both facing each other, it's tough really to hurt yourself, in the sense that, take rugby league for example, it's not tough to hurt yourself in rugby league, but if you're running head on at another guy, you can brace, duck, etc. But if the ball were to be passed forward of you, not back in rugby, and you're running forward of it and there's someone coming the other way, the opportunity for a head clash is huge. And
just
a head...
controlling that impact becomes more difficult.
Like, exactly.
You don't control the impact, and therefore there's... Yeah.
It's interesting, because commentary says that it is perfectly feasible to assume the committee, that's the committee that at the Parade Hotel, recognized this and chose to exclude an offside law, at least in part because of player safety. So Coventry argues that if you're running into each other at every single stage throughout the game, you're going to hurt yourself.
Yeah.
Yes.
So his argument was that...
He was minimising contact.
Minimise contact by making no offside.
Yeah.
Yes. But if you do have offside and then you have... A blurring of those rules, or if those rules are slightly elastic, you almost welcome head-on clashes. And I imagine that if you're a head clash or a concussion in those days, it's real darn dangerous.
I think the biggest thing is as well, this is not an open field. So
he
like,
said darn though. Can we focus on that?
He did say darn,
didn't he?
He's had some absolute rippers so far, Liam, I'll tell you. Absolute rippers. Now, I think the biggest thing is, though, with the impact and the idea is, I think the idea that maybe offside being taken away somehow becomes less dangerous is because of the fact that we're still talking about scrums, okay? So massive groups of people.
Yeah.
Now, with an offside line, they're only coming from one direction. There's an enormous amount of force because they're all together. You take away the offside line, people are going to start rotating in different ways, coming from different directions, hopefully, and therefore you reduce the impact of, I don't know, you know, 10 men and 10 men. So I think that's kind of the thinking sort of, you know, behind it. But that all goes out the window once Mr. Wills decides that, okay, we're going to do this, and we're going to run here, we're going to run here, we're going to run here.
So the game effectively changes from this point forward. So from the early 1860s, the game becomes a real thing that a burgeoning economy of Melbourne as a colony come to own and champion as their own. Wills himself believes that the ball being carried on from one end of the ground to the other by succession of good, well-directed kicks to the hands of those the ball was intended for and so effectually brought up to the goal has very pretty effect and is the result of some skill. He wants the game played in that way. Mm. He wants the game being from hand to foot being kicked, marked and moved on. It's not the beautiful high marking game yet, but it does become that and he is chiefly responsible for that. Our episode today has effectively decided to, I suppose, track the excitement that some British guys, privileged British guys saw as having seen draft forms of and making a good copy of in Melbourne. Had they not have done it, we wouldn't have our AFL and we wouldn't have had our beautiful VFL. In the progressive episodes, we'll look at the expansion of this game, exactly how it became a game that people were obsessed with and how our beautiful parklands around Melbourne and even all the way out to Geelong became places where the game was played similarly but equally uniquely and then eventually became the VFA and then the VFL. Let's thank you very much to Finn O'Sullivan.
Thank you very much, gentlemen.
And thank you to Ryan Miller.
Thanks for your time.
And it's thank you from me.